others. Over the next few days, as you mentally rehearse your new ideal of self, you continue to install more neurological hardware so you'll have the proper circuits in place. In effect, a new software program when you actually interact with your mother-in-law. For most of us, to go from thinking to doing is like inspiring snails to pick up the pace. We want to stay in the intellectual, philosophical realm of our reality. We like to identify with the memorized, recognizable feeling of our familiar self. Instead, by surrendering old thought patterns, interrupting habitual emotional reactions, and foregoing knee-jerk behaviors, then planning and rehearsing new ways of being, you are putting yourself into the equation of that knowledge you learned, and beginning to create a new mind. You are reminding yourself who you want to be. But there is another step that we must address here. What happened as you began to observe your old personality self related to the familiar thoughts, habitual behaviors, and memorized emotions that you previously connected with your mother-in-law? In a way, you were going into the operating system of the subconscious mind, where those programs exist, and where you were the observer of those programs. When you can become aware of or notice who you are being, you are becoming conscious of your unconscious self. As you began to psychologically project yourself into a potential situation ahead of the actual experience, the impending dinner, you began to rewire your neural circuitry to look as though the event, being compassionate towards your mother-in-law, had already taken place. Once those new neural networks began to fire in unison, your brain created a picture, vision, model, or what I will call a hologram, a multidimensional image, representing the ideal self that you were focused on being. The instant this happened, you made what you were thinking more real than anything else. Your brain captured the thought as the experience and upscaled its gray matter to look as though the experience had already occurred. Soon it's game time and you find yourself sitting at dinner face to face with good old mum. Instead of knee-jerking when her typical behaviors manifest, you stay conscious. Remember what you learned, and decide to try it out. Rather than judging, attacking, or feeling animosity towards her, you do something completely different for you. Like the books encouraged, you stay in the present moment, open your heart, and really listen to what she's saying. You no longer hold her to her past. Lo and behold, you modify your behavior and restrain your impulsive emotional reactions, thereby creating a new experience with your mother-in-law. That activates the limbic brain to cook up a new blend of chemicals, which generates a new emotion. And all of a sudden, you truly start to feel compassion for her. You see her for who she is. You can even see aspects of yourself in her. Your muscles relax, you feel your heart opening, and you breathe deeply and freely. You had such a great feeling that day that it lingers. Now you're inspired and open-minded, and you find that you truly love your mother-in-law. As you couple your new internal feeling of goodwill and love for this person in your external reality, you connect compassion with your mother-in-law. You form an associative memory. Once you began to feel the emotion of compassion, in a sense you, chemically, instructed your body what your mind, philosophically, knew, and that activated and modified some of your genes. Now you've gone from thinking to doing, your behaviors match your conscious intentions, your actions are equal to your thoughts, mind and body are aligned and working together. You did exactly what those people did in those books. So by intellectually learning compassion with your brain and mind, then demonstrating this ideal in your environment through experience, you embodied this elevated feeling. You just conditioned your body to a new mind of compassion. Your mind and body were working together. You embodied compassion. In a sense, the word has become flesh. From your efforts to embody compassion, you now have your neocortex and limbic brain working together. You're out of the box of the familiar, habitual, memorized self, which operates within a set of automatic programs. And you're in a new thinking and feeling cycle. You have experienced how compassion feels, and you like it better than the covert hostility, rejection, and suppressed anger. Hold on, though. You are not yet ready for sainthood. It's not enough to have mind and body working together one time. That got you from thinking to doing. But can you reproduce that feeling of compassion at will? Can you repeatedly embody compassion, independent of conditions in your environment, so that no person or situation could ever create that old state of being in you again? If not, you haven't yet mastered compassion. My definition of mastery is that our internal chemical state is greater than anything in our external world. You are a master when you've conditioned yourself with chosen thoughts and feelings. You have memorized desired emotional chemical states, and nothing in your external life deters you from your aims. No person, no thing, and no experience at any time or place should disrupt your internal chemical coherence. You can think, act, and feel differently whenever you choose. Here's an example. If you can master suffering, you can just as easily master joy. You probably know someone who's mastered suffering, right? So you call her and ask, "How are you?" "So-so." "Listen, I'm going to go out with some friends to a new art gallery and then eat at this restaurant that has really healthy desserts. Afterwards, we're going to listen to some live music. Would you like to come with us?" "No, I don't feel like it." But if she said what she actually meant, she'd say, "I've memorized this emotional state and nothing in my environment, no person, no experience, no condition, no thing, is going to move me from my internal chemical state of suffering. It feels better to be in pain than to let go and be happy. I'm enjoying my addiction for now, and all these things that you want to do might distract me from my emotional dependency." But guess what? We can just as easily master an internal chemical state such as joy or compassion. In the preceding example with your mother-in-law, if you practiced your thoughts, behaviors, and feelings enough times, being compassionate would become rather natural. You would evolve from just thinking about it, to doing something about it, to being it. Being means that it's easy, natural, second nature, routine, and unconscious. Compassion and love would be as automatic and familiar to you as those self-limiting emotions you just changed. So now you need to replicate this experience of thinking, feeling, and acting out of compassion. If you do, you will break the addiction of your past emotional state and neurochemically condition your body and mind to memorize the internal chemical state called compassion better than your conscious mind. Ultimately, if you repeatedly recreate the experience of compassion at will, practicing it independent of any circumstance in your life, your body would become the mind of compassion. You would memorize compassion so well that nothing from your outside world would move you from this state of being. Now all three brains are working together, and you are biologically, neurochemically, and genetically in a state of compassion. When compassion becomes unconditionally ordinary, and familiar to you, you have progressed from knowledge to experience to wisdom. Refer figure 6B1, Memory Systems of the Brain. Wisdom is accumulated knowledge that has been gained through repeated experience. And when being compassionate is as natural as suffering, judging, blaming, or being frustrated, negative, or insecure, now we are wise. We are liberated to seize new opportunities, because somehow life seems to organize itself equal to how or who we are being. Refer figure 6C, Evolving Your Being. Going from thinking to doing to being is a progression that we've all experienced many times, whether it was when we learned to be a driver, a skier, a knitter, or a person to whom speaking a second language has become second nature. Now let's talk about one of evolution's great gifts to us as humans, the ability to go from thinking to being without taking any physical action. Said another way, we can create a new state of being ahead of having an actual material experience. We do this all the time, and it's not a case of fake it till you make it. For example, you have a sexual fantasy in which you inwardly experience all the thoughts, feelings, and actions you look forward to when your partner returns from a trip. You're so present with your internal experience that your body is chemically altered and responds as if that future event is already upon you in that exact moment. You have moved into a new state of being. Similarly, whether you're mentally rehearsing the speech you're going to give, reminding yourself how you're going to handle the confrontation that you need to have with your coworker, or imagining what you want to eat when you're really hungry but stuck in traffic. And in each case, you're thinking about that to the exclusion of everything else. Your body will begin to move into a state of being just by thought alone. Okay, but how far can you take this? Through thinking and feeling alone, can you finally be the person you want to be? Can you create and live a chosen reality, as my daughter did when she experienced the summer job of her dreams? That's where meditation comes in. People use meditative techniques for a lot of reasons, as you know. In this book, you will learn a special meditation designed for a specific purpose, to help you overcome the habit of being yourself and become that ideal self you desire. Through the remainder of this chapter, we'll connect some of the knowledge we've covered up till now with the meditation you will soon learn. Whenever I discuss meditation or the meditative process, I will be referring to the process that will be our focus in part 3. Meditation allows us to change our brains, bodies, and state of being. Most important, we can make these changes without having to take any physical action or have any interaction with the external environment. Through meditation, we can install the necessary neurological hardware, just as those piano players and finger exercisers made changes through mental rehearsal. Those research subjects used mental rehearsal alone. But for our purposes, it is one component of the meditative process, albeit a very important one. If I asked you to think about the qualities that your ideal self would possess, or if I suggested that you contemplate what it would feel like to be a person of greatness such as Mother Teresa or Nelson Mandela, then just by contemplating a new way of being, you would begin firing your brain in new ways and making a new mind. That's mental rehearsal in action. I'm now asking you to reflect on what it would feel like to be happy, content, satisfied, and at peace. What would you envision for yourself if you were to create a new ideal of you? Essentially, the meditative process allows you to answer this question by bringing together all of the information learned and wired synaptically into your brain about what it means to be happy, content, satisfied, and at peace. In meditation, you take that knowledge and then place yourself in the equation. Instead of merely asking what it would mean to be happy, you put yourself in the position of practicing and thus living in a state of happiness. After all, you know what happiness looks and feels like. You've had past experiences with it yourself. You've seen other people's versions of it. Now you get to pick and choose from that knowledge and experience to create a new ideal of yourself. I've talked about how through the frontal lobe you activate new circuits in new ways to create a new mind. Once you experience that new mind, your brain creates a kind of holographic image that gives you a model to follow in creating your future reality. Because you've installed new neural circuits ahead of any real experience, you don't have to carry out a non-violent revolution as Gandhi did. You don't have to lead your people and be burned at the stake, as Joan of Arc was. You simply have to use your knowledge and experience of those qualities of courage and conviction to produce an emotional effect within you. The result will be a state of mind. By repeatedly producing that state of mind, it will become familiar to you, and you will be wiring new circuits. The more often you produce that state of mind, the more those thoughts will become the experience. Once that thought experience transformation takes place, the end product of that experience will be a feeling, an emotion. When this occurs, your body, as the unconscious mind, does not know the difference between an event that takes place in physical reality and the emotions you created by thought alone. As someone who is conditioning the body to a new mind, you'll find that your thinking brain and the emotional brain are now working in concert. Remember that thoughts are for the brain and feelings are for the body. When you are both thinking and feeling in a specific way, as a part of the meditative process, you are different from when you started out. The newly installed circuits, the neurological and chemical changes that have been produced by those thoughts and emotions, have altered you in such a way that there is physical evidence in the brain and body that shows those changes. At that point, you've moved into a state of being. You're no longer just practicing happiness or gratitude or whatever. You are being grateful or happy. You can produce that state of mind and body every day. You can continually re-experience an event and produce the emotional response to that experience of how you would feel if you were that new, ideal self. If you can get up from your meditative session and be in that new state of being, altered neurologically, biologically, chemically, and genetically, you have activated those changes ahead of any experience, and you will be more prone to acting and thinking in ways equal to who you are being. You have broken the habit of being yourself. Refer figure 6D, thinking to being. As a reminder, when you are in a new state of being, a new personality, you also create a new personal reality. Let me repeat that. A new state of being creates a new personality. A new personality produces a new personal reality. How will you know whether this meditative practice has activated your three brains to produce the intended effect? Simple. You will feel different as a result of investing in the process. If you feel exactly as you did before, if the same catalysts produce the same reactions in you, then nothing has happened in the quantum field. Your same thoughts and feelings are reproducing the same electromagnetic signal in the field. You haven't changed chemically, neurologically, genetically, or in any other way. But if you eventually get up after your meditation sessions and feel different from when you began them, and if you can maintain that modified state of mind and body, then you have changed. What you've changed inside of you, the new state of being that you created, should now produce an effect outside of you. You have moved beyond the cause and effect model of the universe, that old Newtonian concept of something external to you, controlling your thoughts, actions, and emotions. I'll return to this point in a bit. You will also know that your meditation has been fruitful if something unexpected and new shows up in your life as a result of your efforts. Remember, the quantum model tells us that if you have created a new mind and a new state of being, you have an altered electromagnetic signature. Because you are thinking and feeling differently, you are changing reality. Together, thoughts and feelings can do this. Separately, they cannot. Let me remind you again. You can't think one way and feel another, and expect anything in your life to change. The combination of your thoughts and feelings is your state of being. Change your state of being, and change your reality. Here's where coherent signals really come into play. If you can send into the quantum field a signal coherent in thought and feeling, state of being, independent of the external world, then something different will show up in your life. When it does, you will no doubt experience a powerful emotional response, which will inspire you to create a new reality once again. And you can use that emotion to generate an even more wonderful experience. Let me get back to Newton. We are all conditioned by the Newtonian notion that life is dominated by cause and effect. When something good happens to us, we express gratitude or joy. So we go through life wanting for someone or something outside of ourselves to regulate our feelings. Instead, I'm asking you to take control and to invert the process. Rather than waiting for an occasion to cause you to feel a certain way, create the feeling ahead of any experience in the physical realm. Convince your body emotionally that a gratitude-generating experience has already taken place. To do this, you can pick a potential in the quantum field and get in touch with how it would feel if you were experiencing it. I'm asking you to use your thought and feeling to put yourself in the shoes of that future self, that possible you, so vividly that you begin to emotionally condition your body to believe that you are the person now. When you open your eyes after your meditative session, who do you want to be? What would it feel like to be this ideal self, or to have this desired experience? To fully break the habit of being yourself, say goodbye to cause and effect and embrace the quantum model of reality. Choose a potential reality that you want, live it in your thoughts and feelings, and give thanks ahead of the actual event. Can you accept the notion that once you change your internal state, you don't need the external world to provide you with a reason to feel joy, gratitude, appreciation, or any other elevated emotion? When your body experiences that the event is occurring in that moment, and it feels real to you, based solely on what you're focused on mentally and feeling emotionally, then you are experiencing the future now. The moment you are in the state of being, in that now moment and present in that experience, that's when you're connected to all possible realities that exist in the quantum field. Remember that if you are in the past or the future, based on your familiar emotions or anticipation of some effect, you don't have access to all possibilities the quantum field holds. The only way to access the quantum field is by being in the now. Keep in mind that this concept cannot just be an intellectual process. Thoughts and feelings must be coherent. In other words, this meditation requires that you drop down about 10 inches out of your head and move into your heart. Open your heart and think about how it would feel if you embodied a combination of all the traits that you admire and that make up your ideal self. You may object that you can't know how it would feel because you've never experienced what it's like to have those traits and to be that ideal self. My response is that your body can experience this before you have any physical evidence, ahead of your senses. If a future desire that you've never experienced actually does manifest in your life, you'd have to agree that you would experience an elevated emotion, such as joy, excitement, or gratitude. So those emotions are what you can naturally focus on. Instead of being enslaved to emotions that are only the residue of the past, you are now using elevated emotions to create the future. The elevated emotions of gratitude, love, and so forth all have a higher frequency that will help you to move into a state of being where you can feel as though the desired events have actually occurred. If you are in a state of greatness, then the signal you send into the quantum field is that the events have already come to pass. Giving thanks allows you to emotionally condition your body to believe that what is producing your gratitude has already happened. By activating and coordinating your three brains, meditation allows you to move from thinking to being. And once you are in a new state of being, you are more prone to act and think equal to who you are being. Perhaps you've wondered why it may be so hard to move into a state of gratitude or to give thanks ahead of the actual experience. Is it possible that you've been living by a memorized emotion that has become so much a part of your identity on a subconscious level that now you cannot feel any other way than you're accustomed to? If so, maybe your identity has become a matter of how you appear to the world on the outside, to distract you and change how you feel on the inside. In the next chapter, we're going to examine how to close that gap and to bring about true liberation. When you can readily feel gratitude or joy or fall in love with the future without needing any person, thing, or experience to cause you to feel that way, then these elevated emotions will be available to fuel your creations. Chapter 7. The Gap. I was sitting on my couch one day, thinking about what it means to be happy. As I contemplated my utter lack of joy, I thought about how most people who were important to me would have given me a pep talk right on the spot. I imagined it verbatim. You're so incredibly lucky. You have a wonderful family which includes beautiful kids. You are a successful chiropractor. You lecture to thousands of people. You travel the world going to unusual places. You were featured in What the Bleep Do We Know, and many people loved your message. You even wrote a book and it's doing well. They would have hit all of the right emotional and logical notes, but to me, something wasn't right. I was at a point in my life where I was traveling from city to city every weekend doing lectures. Sometimes I was in two cities within 3 days. It occurred to me that I was so busy that I had no time to actually practice what I was teaching. This was an unnerving moment because I began to see that all of my happiness was created from outside of me, and that the joy I experienced when I was traveling and lecturing had nothing to do with real joy. It appeared to me that I needed everyone, everything, and every place outside of me in order to feel good. This image that I was projecting to the world was dependent on external factors. And when I was not out lecturing or doing interviews or treating patients and I was home, I felt empty. Don't get me wrong, in some ways those things outside of me were great. If you had asked anyone who saw me lecturing, deeply engrossed in working on a presentation during a flight, or answering dozens of emails while in an airport or hotel lounge, such an observer would have said that I appeared to be pretty happy. Sad truth is that If you had asked me at one of those moments, I would have probably responded in much the same way. Yes, things are great. I'm doing well. I'm a lucky guy. But if you had caught me in a quiet moment, when all of those other stimuli weren't bombarding me, I would have responded in a completely different manner. Something's not right. I feel unsettled. Everything feels like the same old. Something is missing. On the day I recognized the core reason for my unhappiness, I also realized that I needed the external world to remember who I was. My identity had become the people I talked to, the cities I visited, the things I did while I was traveling, and the experiences I needed in order to reaffirm myself as this person called Joe Dispenza. And when I wasn't around anyone who could help me recall this personality that the world might know as me, I wasn't sure who I was anymore. In fact, I saw that all my perceived happiness was really just a reaction to stimuli in the external world that made me feel certain ways. I then understood that I was totally addicted to my environment, and I was dependent on external cues to reinforce my emotional addiction. What a moment for me! I had heard a million times that happiness comes from within, but it never hit me like this before. As I sat on the couch in my house that day, I looked out the window and an image came to me. I envisioned my two hands, one above the other, separated by a gap. Refer figure 7A, the identity gap. The top hand represented how I appeared on the outside, and the bottom was how I knew myself to be on the inside. In my self-reflection, it dawned on me that we human beings live in a duality, as two separate entities, how we appear and who we really are. How we appear is the image or the facade that we project to the world. That self is everything we do in order to show up looking a certain way and to present to others a consistent exterior reality. This first aspect of the self is a veneer of how we want everyone to see us. How we really are, represented by the bottom hand, is how we feel, especially when we are not distracted by the external environment. It is our familiar emotions when we are not preoccupied by life. It's what we hide about ourselves. When we memorize addictive emotional states such as guilt, shame, anger, fear, anxiety, judgment, depression, self-importance, or hatred, we develop a gap between the way we appear and the way we really are. The former is how we want other people to see us. The latter is our state of being when we are not interacting with all of the different experiences, diverse things, and assorted people at various times and places in our lives. If we sit long enough without doing anything, we begin to feel something. That something is who we really are. Refer figure 7B, the layers of emotion we memorize that create the gap. Layer by layer, we wear various emotions, which form our identity. In order to remember who we think we are, we have to recreate the same experiences to reaffirm our personality and the corresponding emotions. As an identity, we become attached to our external world by identifying with everyone and everything in order to remind us how we want to project ourselves to the world. How we appear becomes the facade of the personality, which relies on the external world to remember who it is as a somebody. Its identity is completely attached to the environment. The personality does everything it can to hide how it really feels, or to make that feeling of emptiness go away. I own these cars, I know these people, I've been to these places, I can do these things, I've had these experiences, I work for this company, I am successful. It is who we think we are in relation to everything around us. But that is different from who we are, how we feel without the stimulation of our outer reality. Feelings of shame and anger about a failed marriage, fear of death and uncertainty about the afterlife, related to the loss of a loved one or even a pet, a sense of inadequacy due to a parent's insistence on perfectionism and achievement at all costs, a sense of stifled entitlement from having grown up in circumstances barely above poverty, a preoccupation with thoughts of not having the right body type in order to look a certain way to the world. These kinds of feelings are what we want to conceal. This is who we truly are, the real self hiding behind the image we are projecting. We can't face exposing that self to the world, so we pretend to be someone else. We create a set of memorized, automatic programs that work to cover the vulnerable parts of us. Essentially, we lie about who we are because we know that societal mores do not have room for that person. That is the nobody. That is the person whom we doubt others will like and accept. Particularly when we are younger and forming our identity, we are more likely to engage in this type of masquerade. We see young people trying on identities like they try on clothes. And in truth, what teens wear is often a reflection of who they want to be, more than it reflects who they really are. Ask any mental health professional who specializes in working with young people, and she will tell you that one word defines what it is like to be an adolescent: insecurity. As a result, teens and preteens seek comfort in conformity and in numbers. Rather than let the world know what you are really like, adopt and adapt, because everyone knows what happens to those who are perceived to be different. The world is complex and scary, but make it less frightening and much simpler by lumping everyone into groups. Pick your group, pick your poison. Eventually, that identity fits. You grow into it, or at least that's what you tell yourself. Along with the insecurity comes a great deal of self-consciousness. Questions abound. Is this who I really am? Is this who I really want to be? But it's so much easier to ignore those questions than to answer them. All of us have been emotionally scarred from traumatic or difficult experiences as young people. Early in life, we experienced defining events, the emotions of which contributed layer by layer to who we became. Let's face it, we all have been branded by emotionally charged events. As we mentally reviewed the experience repeatedly, the body began to relive the event over and over, just by thought alone. We kept the refractory period of emotional running for so long that we journeyed from a mere emotional reaction to a mood, to a temperament, and ultimately, to a personality trait. While we are young, we keep busy doing things that, for a while, stave off those old, deep emotions, sweeping them under the rug. It is intoxicating to make new friends, travel to unknown places, work hard and achieve a promotion, learn a new skill, or take up a new sport. We seldom suspect that many of these actions are motivated by feelings left over from certain earlier events in life. Then we really get busy. We go to school and possibly college. We buy a car. We move to a new town, state, or country. We begin a career, We meet new people. We get married. We buy a house. We have kids. We adopt pets. We may get divorced. We work out. We start a new relationship. We practice a skill or a hobby. We use everything that we know in the external world to define our identity and to distract us from how we really feel inside. And since all of these unique experiences produce myriad emotions, we notice that those emotions seem to take away any feelings that we are hiding. And it works. For a while. Don't get me wrong. We all reach greater heights from applying ourselves throughout different periods in our growing years. In order to accomplish many things in our lifetimes, we have to push ourselves outside of our comfort zones and go beyond familiar feelings that once defined us. I am certainly aware of this dynamic in life, but when we never overcome our limitations and continue carrying the baggage from our past, it will always catch up with us. And this usually happens starting around our mid-30s. This can vary greatly from one person to another. By our mid-30s or 40s, when the personality is complete, we have experienced much of what life has to offer. And as a result, we can pretty much anticipate the outcome of most experiences. We already know how they're going to feel before we engage in them, because we've had several good and bad relationships, we've competed in business or settled into our career, we've suffered loss and encountered success, or we know what we like and dislike. We know the nuances of life. Since we can predict the likely emotions ahead of an actual experience, we determine whether we want to experience that known event before it actually occurs. Of course, all of this is happening behind the scenes of our awareness. Here is where it gets sticky. Because we can predict the feelings that most events will bring, we already know what will make our feelings about who we really are go away. However, when we reach midlife, nothing can completely take away that feeling of emptiness. You wake up every morning and you feel like the same person. Your environment, which you relied on so heavily to remove your pain or guilt or suffering, is no longer taking away those feelings. How could it? You already know that when the emotions derived from the external world wear off, you will return to being the same leopard who hasn't changed its spots. This is the midlife crisis that most people know about. Some try really hard to make buried feelings stay buried by diving further into their external world. They buy the new sports car, thing. Others lease the boat, another thing. Some go on a long vacation, place. Yet others join the new social club to meet new contacts or make new friends. People. Some get plastic surgery. Body. Many completely redecorate or remodel their homes. Acquire things and experience a new environment. All of these are futile efforts to do or try something new, so that they can feel better or different. But emotionally, when the novelty wears off, they are still stuck with the same identity. They return to who they really are, that is, the bottom hand. They are drawn back to the same reality that they have been living for years, just to keep the feeling of who they think they are as an identity. The truth is, the more they do, the more they buy and then consume, the more noticeable the feeling of who they really are becomes. When we're trying to escape this emptiness, or when we're running from any emotion whatsoever that is painful, it is because to look at it is too uncomfortable. So when the feeling starts to get a bit out of control, most people turn on the TV, surf the internet, or call or text someone. In a matter of moments, we can alter our emotions so many times. We can view a sitcom or a YouTube video and laugh hysterically. Then watch a football game and feel competitive. Then watch the news and be angered or fearful. All of these outer stimuli can easily distract us from those unwanted feelings inside. Technology is a great distraction and a powerful addiction. Think about it. You can immediately change your internal chemistry and make a feeling go away by changing something outside of you. And whatever it was outside of you that made you feel better inside of you, you will rely on that thing in order to sidetrack yourself over and over again. But this strategy doesn't have to involve technology. Anything momentarily thrilling will do the trick. When we keep that diversion up, guess what eventually happens? We grow more dependent on something outside of us to change us internally. Some people unconsciously delve deeper and deeper into this bottomless pit, using different aspects of their world to keep themselves preoccupied, in an effort to recreate the original feeling from the very first experience that helped them escape. They become overstimulated so that they can feel different from how they really are. But sooner or later, everyone realizes that they need more and more of the same to make them feel better. This becomes an all-consuming search for pleasure and ways to avoid pain at all costs. A hedonistic life unconsciously driven by some feeling that won't seem to go away. At this time of life, other people who don't strive to keep their feelings buried ask some big questions. Who am I? What is my purpose in life? Where am I going? Who am I doing all this for? What is God? Where do I go when I die? Is there more to life than success? What is happiness? What does this all mean? What is love? Do I love myself? Do I love anyone else? And the soul begins to wake up. These types of questions begin to occupy the mind because we see through the illusion and suspect that nothing outside of us can ever make us happy. Some of us ultimately realize that nothing in our environment is going to fix the way we feel. We also recognize the enormous amount of energy it takes to keep up this projection of self as an image to the world, and how exhausting it is to keep the mind and body constantly preoccupied. Eventually, we come to see that our futile attempt to maintain an ideal for others is really a strategy to make sure that those impending feelings we've been running from never capture us. How long can we juggle keeping so many balls in the air just so our lives don't come crashing down? Instead of buying a bigger TV or the latest smartphone, these people stop running from the feeling that they've been trying to make go away for so long. Face it head on and intently look at it. When this happens, the individual begins to wake up. After some self-reflection, she discovers who she really is, what she has been hiding, and what no longer is working for her. So she lets go of the facade, the games, and the illusions. She is honest about who she really is, at all costs, and she is not afraid to lose it all. This person stops expending the energy she has been putting into keeping an illusory image intact. She gets in touch with her feelings and then turns to the people in her life and says, "You know what? It doesn't matter if I don't make you happy any longer. I'm through obsessing about how I look or what other people think about me. I'm finished living for everyone else. I want to be free from these chains." This is a profound moment in a person's life. The soul is waking up and nudging her to tell the truth about who she really is. The lie is over. Most relationships are based on what you have in common with others. Think about this. You meet a person, and immediately the two of you compare your experiences, as if you both are checking to see whether your neural networks and emotional memories are aligned. You say something like this: I know these people. I am from this place. And I lived in these places at these different times in my life. I went to this school and studied this subject. I own and do these things. And most important, I've had these experiences. Then the other person responds, I know those people. I've lived in those places during those times. I do these things too. I've had those same experiences. Thus, you can relate to each other. A relationship is then formed based on neurochemical states of being, because if you share the same experiences, you share the same emotions. Think of emotions as energy in motion. If you share the same emotions, you share the same energy. And just like two atoms of oxygen that share an invisible field of energy beyond space and time, in order to bond together in a relationship to form air, you are bonded in an invisible field of energy to everything, person, and place in your external life. Bonds between people are the strongest, though, because emotions hold the strongest energy. As long as either party doesn't change, things will be just fine. Refer figure 7C, Emotional Bonds. So when our friend in the example in the last section begins to tell the truth about how she really feels, things begin to get very uncomfortable. If her friendships have been based upon complaining about life, then she is bonded energetically to her relationships by the emotions of victimization. If, in a moment of enlightenment, she now decides to break from that habit of being herself, she is no longer showing up as that familiar person to whom everyone could relate. People in her life are using her to remind themselves of who they are emotionally as well. Friends and family respond, "What is wrong with you today? You've hurt my feelings." Which translates to, "I thought we had a good thing going on here. I used you to reaffirm my emotional addiction in order to remember who I think I am as a somebody. I liked you better the other way." When it comes to change, our energy is connected to everything that we've ever had an experience with in our outer world. When we break the addiction of emotion we've memorized, or when we tell the truth about who we really are, doing that takes some real energy. Just as it takes energy to separate two atoms of oxygen that are bonded together, it takes energy to break the bonds with the people in our lives. So the individuals in this person's life who have shared the same emotional bonds with her rally together and say, "She hasn't been herself lately. Maybe she's lost her mind. Let's get her to a doctor." Now remember that they have been the people she shared the same experiences with. Hence, they shared the same emotions. But now, she's breaking the energetic bonds with everyone and everything, and even every place familiar. This is a threatening moment for everyone who has been playing the same game with her for years. She's getting off the train. So they bring her to the doctor, who gives her Prozac or some other drug. And in a short time, the person's former personality returns. And there she is, projecting her old image to the world, right back to shaking hands on others' emotional agreements. Once more, she's numb and smiling, anything to take the feeling away. The lesson goes unlearned. Yes, the person wasn't being herself. Not the top-hand self that everyone had grown accustomed to. Instead, briefly, she was the bottom-hand self, the one with the past and the pain. And who can blame those loved ones who insisted on the return to her former numbered self, that went along to get along? That new self emerged as unpredictable, even radical. Who wants to be around that person? Who wants to be around the truth? If you need the environment in order to remember who you are as a somebody, what happens when you die and the environment rolls up and disappears? Do you know what goes with it? The somebody, the identity, the image, the personality, top hand, that is identified with all of the known and predictable elements in life, who is addicted to the environment. You could have been the most successful, popular, or beautiful person, and you could have had all of the wealth you ever needed. But when your life ends, and your external reality is taken away, everything outside of you can no longer define you. It all goes. What you're left with is who you really are. Bottom hand. Not how you appear. When your life is over and you cannot rely on your external world to define you, you will be left with that feeling you never addressed. You would not have evolved as a soul in that lifetime. For instance, if you had certain experiences 50 years prior that marked you as insecure or weak, and you felt that way about yourself ever since, then you stopped growing emotionally 50 years ago. If the soul's purpose is to learn from experience and gain wisdom, but you stayed stuck in that particular emotion, you never turned your experience into a lesson. You didn't transcend that emotion and exchange it for any understanding. While that feeling still anchors your mind and body to those past events, you are never free to move into the future. And if a similar experience shows up in your present life, that event will trigger the same emotion, and you will act as that person you were 50 years ago. So your soul says, "Pay attention. I'm letting you know that nothing is bringing you joy. I'm sending you urges. If you keep playing this game, I'm going to stop trying to get your attention, and you'll go back to sleep. Then I'll see you when this life is over." Most people who do not know how to change think, "How can I make this feeling go away?" And if the novelty of accumulating new things wears off and stops working, what do? They look to bigger things, a whole other layer above where they were, and their avoidance strategies become addictions. If I take a drug or drink enough alcohol, that's going to make this feeling go away. This external thing will produce an internal chemical change and make me feel great. I'll shop a lot because shopping, even if I don't have the money, makes that emptiness go away. I'll watch pornography. I'll play video games. I'll gamble. I'll overeat. Refer figure 7D, the midlife crisis, an attempt to create a new identity from the outside. Whatever the addiction, people are still thinking that some external thing is going to take that internal feeling away. And remember, we have this natural propensity to associate an external thing that's making that feeling go away with our internal chemical change. And we like that external thing if it makes us feel good. So we run away from what feels bad or painful, and we move towards what feels good and comfortable or brings us pleasure. As the excitement people get from their addiction continually stimulates the pleasure centers in the brain, they get a flood of chemicals from the thrill of the experience. The problem is that each time they gamble, binge, or stay up late playing online games, they need a little more the next time. The reason why people need more drugs, or more shopping, or more affairs, is that the chemical rush that's created from those activities activates the receptor sites on the outside of their cells, which turns on the cells. But if receptor sites are continually stimulated, they get desensitized and shut off, So, they need a stronger signal, a bit more stimulation, to turn them on the next time. It takes a bigger chemical